Our gospel reading is from John chapter 4, and I'll actually read verses 4 through 24, which is about the first half of this story. One of my favorite preachers and commentators, Anna Carter Florence, who teaches preaching at Columbia Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, says that if she were to pick one story that shows us the most about who Jesus is, it would be this one, this story about Jesus and the woman at the well. And I totally agree. Each time I reread this story, each time I go back to the well, I find something new to carry home in my bucket. And so let's listen. This is John chapter 4, starting at verse 4. Jesus had to go through Samaria. So he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" And in parenthetical comments, Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. And Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us the well and with his sons and his flocks drank from it?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." And Jesus answered her, "Go, call your husband and come back." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I have a question for you. Do you remember that story in the Gospels where Jesus met his future wife? Yes? No? Maybe. Emma and I recently saw a performance of the Da Vinci Code by the Palo Alto Players. And if you're familiar with the novel by Dan Brown and the subsequent movie, Dan Brown made a big deal about Jesus having married Mary Magdalene. But I'm not talking about Mary Magdalene. I'm talking about here in John 4, the woman at the well. And bear with me for a second. In the book of Genesis, when Abraham's servant tries to find Isaac a wife, do you remember what he does? He sits down by a well and he prays, "Dear God, may the first woman who comes here and offers to give me a drink and also water my camels be the woman that will be Isaac's wife. And so sure enough, Rebekah comes, offers to give him a drink and to water his camels, and then Isaac and Rebekah get married. Later, their son Jacob meets his wife Rachel at a well. And how did Moses meet his future wife, Zipporah? Also at a well. And earlier in the Gospel of John, John the Baptist has already called Jesus the bridegroom. And so the original hearers of this gospel may have been set up to think, okay, this is where Jesus meets his wife. That's that kind of story. And I think for later readers of the gospel, as Samaritans and those of different backgrounds were coming and trying to be a part of the church, this was a deeply symbolic sign that all were welcome, that Jesus, the bridegroom of the church, was also marrying Samaritans and all people and bringing them together, fully accepting them into the church. And always in the Gospel of John, there are so many multiple layers to the story. There's a literal story level, but there's also a much larger symbolic level as well. And notice that the woman came to the well at noon. And there have been a number of commentators that have said that, well, she came to the well at noon because she must have been ostracized from the other women in the village because of her shady past. And so she couldn't go to the well, you know, at the early in the morning when it was cooler or late in the evening when it was cooler. And so because she was ostracized, she must have gone to the well at noon. And that might be the case. But there are no commentators who suggested that prior to the 19th century. And so it's a relatively new interpretation. There's nothing that indicates that Samaritans had that custom where they would have ostracized someone and made her have to go to the well alone by herself at noon. And I think there's another possibility. In the prior chapter, when Nicodemus, who doesn't quite trust Jesus, goes to see Jesus at night because he doesn't want the other Pharisees to know that he's going to see Jesus. In that story, Nicodemus is hesitant, he's afraid, he sees Jesus at night. In the Gospel of John, night or darkness is always a sign for a lack of understanding or refusing to understand. But she encounters Jesus at high noon, when all pretense is gone, nothing is hidden. And that is our signal that John is casting this conversation in a very positive light. And so this woman may not be ostracized at all, but instead she is the ideal disciple encountering Jesus at noon, even if she has had five husbands. And it's important to note that in that culture, a husband could divorce a wife for very trivial reasons. And only husbands had the power to divorce. So if she has been divorced five times, it could be that she's been divorced for very trivial reasons each time. Or she could have outlived five husbands. We don't know. Or maybe there's a mixture of husbands divorcing her and husbands dying. We don't know. We don't know for sure. The Western Church has had a tendency to criticize her or to emphasize that she must have somehow had a shady reputation. But not so in the Eastern Church. In the Eastern Church, she's called Saint Fontaine. And they tend to regard her in a much more positive light. I like to do a lot of research on Ancestry.com, and I have a great-great-grandfather, Daniel Cabanis, who is married at least four times, and at least three of his wives actually outlived him, and there's no record of him having ever gotten divorced. So he seems to have been a serial bigamist. And he also seems to have altered the spelling of our last name slightly each time he got married. So if you want to wag the finger at someone, wag the finger at him. He seems to have been kind of a cad. And his eldest son, my great-grandfather, eventually became a very devout Baptist. And to me, I get the impression that he did everything he could to live his life the exact opposite of the way his father lived. And also consider this. If this story is as much about the Samaritan people as it is about her, if you go back to 2 Kings chapter 17, which talks about what happened to the people of Samaria after the northern kingdom of Israel, including Samaria, had been conquered by the Assyrians. It says that the Assyrians had colonized 5 different national groups to settle in Samaria and to intermarry with the people there. 5 husbands, 5 different groups conquered. And perhaps the 6 that they weren't technically married to were the Romans themselves. And maybe the 7th is actually Jesus, representing a whole and complete number. And again, this union of people. And what we see Jesus doing here is breaking down that ancient enmity between Jews and Samaritans, breaking down those barriers. About 30 years ago, I had the privilege of meeting Father Elias Chakor, who is a Melkite priest, an Eastern priest associated with the Roman Catholic Church. And in Nazareth, he established a school where Muslims, Jews, and Christians were all students together in the school. And he had that going for many, many years. And I remember a story that he shared with us. He said that when people would ask, "What were you born?" they usually expected you to say what religion you were born into. Were you born a Jew? Were you born a Christian? Were you born a Muslim? And Father Chakor said that he would always answer that question by saying, "I was born a baby." Full stop. And what we see here, I believe, is that Jesus is the one breaking down barriers between Samaritans and Jews, between any ancient people with ancient rivalries. But whatever her past, even if she did have what some people might consider a shady past, or if she has been unfairly divorced by 5 different men, we don't know. Whatever her past, what we can certainly agree on based on what we know in the story is that she was thirsty. She came to the well thirsty, with a bucket, hoping to be fulfilled, hoping to have her own thirst quenched. One of my favorite writers, Frederick Buechner, once defined lust as the craving for salt of someone who is dying of thirst. And I find that incredibly profound. All of us are thirsty, but sometimes we lust after the wrong things. And not just a lust for sex, but a lust for power, influence, money, revenge, for some kind of fantasy life that is free of disappointments, regrets, and pain. And all the while, we end up leaving our deepest thirst unfulfilled. And the promise in this text, the promise that Jesus offers is that he is the source of living water, and that those who drink from this water will have their thirst quenched and will not thirst again. And Jesus is not some Pollyannish kind of figure saying, "Yes, I'll quench your thirst miraculously and all at once." Because notice this. Jesus also came to the well thirsty. The one who proclaims himself as a source of living water also came to the well thirsty. And going back to this whole question about meeting at the well at noon, there is one other time in the Gospel of John when Jesus says, "I'm thirsty." And that's in the crucifixion scene in John chapter 19. And do you remember what time of day it was? It was noon. Once again, all these multiple layers to the onion. And so Jesus coming to the well thirsty at noon could also be foreshadowing the crucifixion later on. And again, what does it mean for us that the source of living water is also thirsty? And I believe it means that the one who promises us the living water is someone who has known thirst, who knew what it was like to suffer, who knew what it was like to feel abandoned by God, who knows what it means to despair and doubt. And so Jesus comes to us in authenticity, having experienced all of our joys and sorrows. And again, Jesus doesn't promise to miraculously quench our thirst all at once. But over the course of our spiritual and faith journeys, we find the fulfillment that does help quench our deepest thirst. And it might be as simple as offering someone else a cup of cold water in the name of love, and thereby breaking down a barrier, making a connection. It could come through trial and error as we find for ourselves the springs that yield water and that do not, the ones that quench our thirst and don't. But over a lifetime of faith, over a lifetime of trust, we learn not to crave the salt that only makes the thirst worse, but we learn to yearn for the one who truly quenches our thirst. And there's a marvelous detail in the story that actually came after what I just read. After her whole discussion with Jesus, she becomes so excited that she gets up and runs back to her village to tell everyone about the encounter that she has had with Jesus. And she leaves her water bucket behind. She had gone to the well to draw water, and she ends up leaving her bucket behind. Maybe because now, having met Jesus, the source of living water, she no longer needs that bucket. And just like she left her bucket behind, I believe that ultimately we can quench our deepest thirst from leaving our own buckets behind and going out and joyfully telling others where we have found the life-giving water. All glory and praise be to our God. Amen.